On Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA, it is WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen, the author of Works New Age and Works New Age Blogspot. Dr. James B. Huntington, sir, hello.
Good morning, Doug. Good morning, listeners.
We start with the AJSN, which you can explain what that is, but it tells us pretty much how the economy and jobs are doing right now. And where are we after April's figures, the latest ones that we have?
You know, the AJSN is the American Job Shortage Number. It answers one component. It cleans up one area where people are often asking what's the real unemployment rate and so on and so forth. And the AJSN figures how many new positions, in addition to those that are listed now, could be easily filled if everyone knew that they would be easy, routine, nothing too much to get. So that number gets lower when the latent demand for jobs drops a bit, and it gets higher when we could easily fill more positions.
So did it get higher or lower this month?
So it got lower this month. That's normally good. However, the AJSN is not seasonally adjusted. It goes with the actual numbers. And in this case, the difference between March and April is usually quite substantial, that a lot of people get jobs in April, so latent demand typically dropped. So the AJSN did go down, but not as much as it could have. And looking at the year over year and the other numbers, it was April was not a good month at all.
You talk about the employment to population ratio and the labor force participation rate every month. That sort of makes it easier for some people to understand. And they each dropped a tenth of a percent. Is that significant?
It is. I mean, it makes a difference. It's not huge, but it means something. It rarely goes up or down more than a tenth of a percent. The employment to population ratio is the best number for looking at how many Americans are actually working, because it's just no nonsense, no excuses, no statuses. You add up the number of people who are working and the population, and the share of the population that's working is the employment population ratio. The labor force participation rate is similar, except that it adds in the people who are officially unemployed. So the gap between them is larger during higher unemployment, but it gives you an idea of how many people are not or very close to working or actually working themselves. They're valuable numbers, and they have told us at times a lot more about the job market than have many of the other numbers we hear much more often.
So we have the employment to population ratio 59.1%, and the labor force participation is 61.8%, not that far apart, but if a tenth of a percent is significant, I guess that is then too.
Yes, they both got worse, and that means that people left the labor force, essentially. That's not a good thing. It's not what we want to see. We can't avoid it with an aging population having substantial effect on what those numbers are doing, but they always tell us, these figures always consistently tell us, that more people will say they have no interest in work when the job market is worse, when they have reason for thinking they can't get the job they want. An improving job market can knock 5 or even 10% off the number of people who say they're not interested in a job right now. So there is some flexibility, and it does tell us, really, we're more about where the job market is when those things drop and those things increase this month.
Maybe you can go over again for the people that have not heard this from you before about why somebody might not want to work right now or choose not to pursue a job right now, because the default that some people are going to say is, oh, well, they're lazy, they want to stay home, and they're on the government dole, and we're giving away too much to people who are unemployed in this country, which is not really what that number says.
Well, there is a whole string of different statuses that are inputs into the AJSN. And one, of course, is the number of actual unemployed. For April, that was about just under 6.8 million. So we think that 90% of them would want a job if they found something, you know, had the real opportunity. Some would hang back and avoid working and such things, but there are requirements in order to keep this status. You have to turn in logs, you have to turn in information about showing that you're actually looking for work.
I think
there are other statuses that are not so cut and dry, like people who say, I want to work, but I'm discouraged. I'm just tired of not being able to find anything. And so people like that, I also take as having a 90% chance of accepting a job if it crossed their path that's reasonably close. But there are only not even 500,000 people in that category. They're not quite the same as those who are not working. They have a specific reason for it, and they don't turn up in huge numbers. And it is highly susceptible to going up and down with different conditions. And there are others.
Yeah, you mentioned on the AJSN somebody being discouraged, somebody having family responsibilities, in school or training, ill, or they have a disability at the time. Hopefully they get better. In some cases, disability, not so much. So there are other reasons aside from, oh, I want to sit home and watch The Price is Right. That's
saying. There are cases where somebody loses their job, somebody expects it will be a few months before they will get a new one, and so they help out their grandmother, mm-hmm. who's been really needing someone to come. So they go home and they get tied up into things with her, and they don't think for personal reasons they can just suddenly leave. They're not going to go back home and jump in the job thing for a while. So they count as having said they want to work, but they're in family responsibilities. And the same thing goes within school or training. Well, I've lost my job, so it's time to take that course, that full-time course or several courses that will prevent me from working, really, if I want to finish it for the next month or so. But I still want to work.
Yeah.
So, and these numbers are all relatively, really quite small in terms of numbers. Family responsibilities, and these are typical-ish figures, a little high, but typical. Family responsibilities in April, there were 215,000 claiming that in school or training, 199,000. Ill health or disability, the same thing as I'm sick right now, but if I get better next week, I will be right back in the job market. But for now, it's just not going to happen. 104,000. And then there's the other category with 736,000 that just has people with different temporary reasons that they can't work. They're not saying I'm doing this indefinitely, but for now, for right now, I'm not able to work.
Do we have any figures as to how many people have been unemployed at any time in their life? I mean, first off, the government counts if you work 1 hour a week, you're employed, which I think is hinky, but
Well, they got to pick something, and that's what they chose.
Yeah. But, I mean, do we know how many of us have been unemployed at one time? I've been unemployed twice now. True, I worked part-time jobs before I got back into radio. Mm-hmm. In one case, I worked two jobs part-time.
Well, I think three times for me. I think it's a lot of people. But as far as where to find the data, that would be a good question. I've never researched that, never tried to find that. But, yes, I would imagine the Bureau of Labor Statistics has that somewhere, or somebody does. It's an interesting thing. And it also, but of course, that would not be a totally smooth sort of thing, because how long was the unemployment and so on and so forth? What were you getting in benefits? The states vary drastically in terms of how much they'll give you a week when you are officially unemployed and get the documents. So there may be people, I'm sure there are people who got even more with those benefits than they were working. But then there was Florida, where in 10 or 15 years ago, it was $275 a week, which was something around the minimum wage.
Yeah.
So that helps. I mean, I'm not going to get into a defense or a disagreement with how they set these rates, but how much they are really affects how bad financially unemployment was for you.
Yeah, I like I said, I was on unemployment, but I was also working two jobs. And if I made over a certain amount, I got less that week in unemployment. But it's like, oh, well, you know, it just extends it past the 13 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember the first time I was unemployed, a couple of weeks after I was myself and several people were asked to leave employment by a new owner who came in and replaced a lot of our staff with their staff. I was offered something. They said, well, hey, you know, if you'd like to take a 13-week vacation on Uncle Sam, please go ahead and do that, and we'll hire you in 13 weeks. And I'm thinking, do I really want to work for somebody who thinks that way? I wasn't interested in the job specifically, although it was somewhat interesting, but not quite what I was looking for. So,
well, you would still, I mean, if you were doing that, you would still have to document
right
what jobs you were looking for 13 weeks. I don't think that there's anything matter. Maybe I didn't understand you correctly, but there wouldn't be anything matter with somebody who loses their job today in May and gets told, well, we can hire you in August, guaranteed. And there's nothing the matter with that. And what they choose to do with that time, they could, of course, you know, go and take their vacation and then, as they told me, as the unemployment people told me around the time I did get a job, they said, just don't report your hours as unemployed.
Hmm.
And so you just don't get any money, but you have your time off and you have your job offer.
Yeah, it's I don't know, but I think that some people who've never gone through it have a, shall we say, a wrong view of exactly what you have to go through. Now, I'm sure there are people, and we've all met one or two in our life, who have managed to game the system to the point where they're getting all types of benefits and doing nothing to get out of the situation. And they figured out how to play the game and get the most out of Uncle Sam, out of the state, and out of you and me. And they have no intention of doing anything, but it's not easy. But somehow if they put half that effort into finding a really good job, they could be very successful. But they figure, why bother? I'm just going to sit on my can. But that's a very small number compared to the rest of us who had to sit there and document everything and try.
And as Bruce Williams used to say, I hope they look good in stripes.
Yeah.
Because that's where they're going to end up. I mean, a lot of these things are felonies, and they will catch you.
Well, so, there's always that one person that you've met in your life, and I think everybody knows this person, where they've somehow managed to put a sob story over on everybody, and they just coast through it, where you and I will bust our hump to try to get somewhere. They somehow figured out to, hey, I could just sit back and eat bonbons all day on the government dime. And
yes, if they want to take that risk, that's their own calculated risk, but there's not going to be a lot of sympathy for them.
No.
When it turns out they get
right
called up to court on three felony charges.
Yeah, like I said, that's not the majority of people who are getting assistance. It's but there's some out there, and they make everybody else look bad. Assistance,
well, certainly will be some, but
there
will be stinkers in anything like this, and there are certainly people who lie on this, on the statistics here.
No, they lie. How can you tell? Their lips move. But anyway. Figuring out the rest of this year, we did not make progress in April, according to your article, as well as the results above. Year over year, comparison shows the AJSN up 423,000, with more from nearly all the secondary categories, as well as 169,000 from unemployment, which was almost 200,000 lower than April 2025. And Dr. Huntington always has the metaphorical turtle. It's good to get more jobs, but this time wasn't enough. The turtle stayed right where he was.
Yes, I mean, good jobs are a good thing, and we cannot take even the 67,000 estimate for jobs for granted anymore, but it's not the whole deal, and nothing else really went anywhere good over the last month, so it's looking quite negative as far as how all that goes.
We'll have a link to this particular article on the podcast that will be up at this program on WRTA.com in just a few. We're talking with Dr. James B. Huntington. Up next, a little bit different of a story than you might expect from our usual programs on WRTA. I wasn't even sure if we were going to have a program this month, because Dr. Huntington went through a medical situation. Were you expecting this? Did you know this was coming?
No, I really did not. I had a normal course of events where I was examined, essentially, and the situation was discovered that I was going to need a triple or quadruple bypass.
Heart surgery. Mm-hmm.
Open heart surgery.
So they did have to crack your chest.
Well, they did and they didn't. It's not quite like they would have done 40 years ago where they would have broken all my ribs to get in there. I have a scar that runs, it stops well above my belly button. It's really only on my chest area. I don't know if they even broke any ribs. They got in there, they sort of worked their way around them more than anything else and put in four new arteries around my heart that had become very blocked. Some of them had been replaced. In fact, I had grown new ones. I had sprouted two or three new ones that had worked. So as incredible as it may seem, I went into this thing having had no symptoms.
No symptoms at all? You weren't having shortness of breath or?
Well, I don't know. My girlfriend's commented once before then that I seemed short of breath sometimes when I climbed the stairs. So it's possible that I probably was losing some heart capacity and such without really knowing it. But it was gradual. It may have seemed just like aging. And from what I've heard, when I'm out of this recovery and this occasional pain and all these lovely things, which I still have at least some of, although most of it is over, that I will feel like I'm a lot younger and I will have more energy. And I've been a little bit in doubt of my energy level, that the amount of sleep I've been getting has been crept up from about 7 hours to 10 just over the course of 10 years or something.
Well, I think if you go through something like that, it is a trauma to the body, so you're probably going to need that to recuperate a bit more.
Oh, you know, now I'm getting at least 12. Yes. I mean, I'm really, yes.
I wish I could say I was getting 12 hours of sleep, but I don't want to go through what you did to do that. I will say,
Good point.
My father, my folks moved back to Pennsylvania from New York in 1993. So this would have been in the late 80s. And my dad had had, at that time, 3 heart attacks, and they said, you really do need surgery. Now, the amazing thing to me was, I think it was New York Medical Center where he ended up going to this, because we lived on Long Island. He went to Manhattan for this. Because it was some experimental procedure, we got a heck of a deal. And that sounds ridiculous, or I'm not trying to be funny, but believe me, it helped the finances of this whole thing.
Oh, no, these things are expensive.
Yeah, and he wasn't on Medicare at the time. He was still too young, or he was just about at that age. But the thing that he said is they did have to crack him open, and he says, well, you feel like you have an elephant sitting on your chest until that heals. However, his point was, once that you get over the surgery, not the surgery on the heart, the surgery that where they had to open you up and your chest feels better, he felt 20 years younger. He had retired.
Yes, well, I've seen a small flurry, but still a number of people who have told me that it was, yes, that I wouldn't say it's an elephant on my chest, but I would say now I feel pretty much like I have a bad chest cold. It's just tight and congested in there, and I also have shortness of breath some of the time. I'm not very good. I can climb stairs and do my walking, which is part of my walking, which involves going up and down hills, but I do get winded fairly soon after that.
They call Altoona the Mountain City, and I remember walking downtown, and I had been working out a little more than I usually do, and I didn't even get winded, and I thought, well, this is a strange and wonderful feeling. I didn't really keep up with it, and now I suppose if I did the same thing, I was waiting for somebody for an appointment downtown, so I just walked around the entire downtown, and it's like, wow, I actually feel a little better this way, and it's a night and day difference. My dad had retired. He was an auto mechanic. He did manual labor all his life. And he really couldn't do that anymore. And afterwards, he was like, wow, this is great. And he always worked in the garden in the backyard. And he did everything he could possibly do in that backyard twice, because we didn't have, like, you know, a mansion with acres and acres. He just had a backyard. And he got bored and he said, I got to go back to work. Besides, we could use the dough living in New York State, Long Island especially. And so for another, 5 years or so until they moved back to Pennsylvania, he worked and he didn't mind it at all. I mean, I would love to feel 20 years younger. I don't think any of us want to go through what you went through to feel that way. The interesting thing to me is I have a friend who needed an emergency stent, and he had gone through he was doing a lot of stuff like walking trails and staying fit, and he certainly wasn't overweight. And he started to have problems, and he says, well, it's probably just indigestion. His wife said, no, we're going to the ER. And within a half hour, he's in surgery, and they're putting a stent in his heart.
Good decision.
Yeah, and he's fine now. But the thing was, he had just had a major checkup a month before. They did the EKG, everything. Hey, don't worry. Clean bill of health. You're healthy as a horse. Well, apparently the horse wasn't that healthy because a month later he was in surgery. And you know, I'd been out hiking with the guy, and I didn't get all that winded. He didn't get winded at all. And I'm thinking, thank goodness, because we're out in the middle of nowhere, that he didn't have an emergency then, because it would not have turned out as well, because he was able to get to the hospital in 10 minutes when his wife drove him. I think this is something that, you know, we all have at the back of our mind. Could something like this happen to me? And the answer is, well, yeah, because I don't care how clean or healthy your living is. We're all human, so who knows what's going to happen? You try to do the best you can.
I don't think they are good at all at knowing when somebody might be, say, a year or so away from one of these things. I think that their ability, in order to see how much plaque you have in your arteries, which is the stuff that goes into it, it accumulates at different rates for different people. In order to see that, you really have to go in and do a catheterization. And that's what they did with me. I had had a heart attack 9 years before. It was mild. I had a catheterization back then, and a couple of stents were put in. And the stents are really just cylindrical little devices that open up, that give you more space inside blood vessels at certain points, which can hold you off. But otherwise, they could not tell years later how much plaque and such I had in there. So one or two years before, I think it was 2 years, but I had a routine stress test where they can check and see, and everything was okay, and there was no excess plaque. But then again, you know, an artery can have 50% or whatever of its permissible possible plaque, and you won't be able to see it, and you won't see it, be it through x-rays or anything. So they ran me through another catheterization, and they said, well, there's two possibilities. They ran the catheterization not knowing whether I had any problem at all, because the data they'd picked up in the stress test was ambiguous. Some of it could even have been explained by muscle covering an artery. So they really had to get in there and do that, and they would give me either stents if I needed them, or just take pictures and get out of there if I didn't, or, as they said, stop the procedure if I need more than that. And they stopped the procedure, and the cardiologist said that I looked rather ugly inside, and he drew out this map with me with all of these blockages and such. And I think the arteries that I sprouted helped me get through this. I mean, I could have easily gone for a year or two after this without any symptoms or anything, but they weren't really a permanent solution. So that's what they did in Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx on April 22nd.
Wow.
I'm coming back, and I know I'm much better. I'm getting better by the day. I still have some things that aren't really very good, but everything, as far as I know, everything that's has not completely healed is consistent with the surgery and such I have, and it will heal. So
yeah.
I'm expecting that I'll be back, that within a month, let's say, I'll be completely back, and I'm probably over 50% back now.
Well, you were relatively active. I mean, you travel a great deal. That's one of your things.
Yes.
You do a lot of walking.
Yes, I walk 19 miles a week, so I haven't been able to approach that since the surgery, but I was in, let's say, an above-average 69-year-old's health.
Well, you know, you look at somebody like David Letterman, to pick somebody famous. He had to have heart surgery, and he knew that it was coming because his dad had a certain thing that he died of.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, medical science has got much better, and they were able to watch it, and they said, okay, it's time, and then he had to have the heart surgery. This is a guy who was out running all the time. He's still thin. I doubt he's been all that much overweight in his life. So here's somebody who keeps himself in good health, but still had to have something like that done because it was congenital. It was just going to always be there hanging over his head. And luckily they were able to do something for it.
Well, before my heart attack, I had never seen a cardiologist and had no reason to think anything was wrong. But they plugged me into this system of getting a stress test, really walking fast and then running on a treadmill and hooking up all kinds of things to look at what was happening with my heart and its arteries and other things like that. So after that, there was really no, without that, I wouldn't have known. I mean, people remarkably often get massive heart attacks without having ever seen a cardiologist because they have no idea it was there. So in his case, they may have done the equivalent of giving him a stress test every year or something like that. And so they would know in advance, they would have some reason to think when it was coming. I imagine that's what he had, that he was, they wouldn't just put him on a calendar and say, your father did this, but they would say, you're at a major risk of this. And so we need to know when we have to do something like this bypass.
Yeah. And when you look at something like this, you think about lifestyle, you think about whether you've taken care of yourself, and it can come to any person. So
there are just so many personal differences. I mean, so many people who don't ever have heart problems.
Yeah.
And then there are other problems, of course, that I've never had.
Right.
So it varies so much. There's really no way of knowing. I think what is badly needed, what I hope would happen within this area over the next 50 years, would be a way that they could give you some kind of super chest x-ray or something that would zero in, that would tell you how much plaque was in your coronary arteries.
You know,
because that's what this is all about.
I'm wondering if AI will not be able to help with that. We talk about AI in medicine a lot. Maybe that is going to be a positive use of AI.
Very possibly. If it can discover patterns that we don't know. Some of the old patterns are no good, just as far as one thing that goes with me, I've never in my life had a problem with high cholesterol. I had a cholesterol of 160 or 180 or something right before the heart attack I did have.
Mm.
And they gave me something to bring that down, and it brought it down to laughable levels.
Yeah.
And they decreased the dose to almost nothing. But it turned out the cholesterol level was not a good indicator of how much plaque I had in my arteries. So that it's we're just missing big pieces of this kind of thing. And I know even doctors could get in a rut of thinking, well, someone has low cholesterol, therefore they aren't going to have any heart problems. And we know now, we're getting to know more and more, that is not the case, and that what it maybe you can get away with having a cholesterol of 200, and that's really good, but it maybe mine needs to be something like 50 or less for the rest of my life.
What advice would you give to somebody who's facing something like this?
Well, let's see. I would say, first of all, I'm not all the way back. I'm not over this mountain yet, but I would say it's not nearly as scary as it used to be once. It's not really a life-endangering proposition having this kind of thing. They're quite common. They've been doing them for 50 years or something now, and I think death rates and stroke rates and such of these things are really very low. So go with it, and you know, there may be it's I don't think, maybe I'm too optimistic, but I don't think my heart is really going to contribute. If I can make it to say 90, I really doubt that anything before that is going to be, or my life is going to be shortened by any sort of heart thing. So just realize that it's changed a great deal. It is common. It is, you will feel pretty rotten afterwards. I can account for that. But you will have, if you are with a good hospital and a good surgeon, and I think there are a lot of good cardiothoracic surgeons like the one I had who've now done a lot of these things. So you should expect that it will go through without any critical problems.
Well, considering that they have probably improved it a great deal since my dad had his surgery, and it made him feel, like I said, 20 years younger, they said, well, this is experimental. We think that we've done the best we can do for you. Figure you'll have another 6 years of life. He lived 18 mm-hmm. more years. And that mm-hmm. was back then. So now, who, like you say, you could make it to 90 easily.
Well, there was a reference book or something which said, I read many decades ago, probably close to 50 years ago, that said that once you'd had a heart attack, your life expectancy was no more than a year. That was before they had catheterizations and before they really understood there was anything they could do about problems like this. Sometimes they just jump in and do the open heart surgery, even though it was a lot more dangerous and less well established, but generally, there is not as much you can do now. I don't think it's a factor. I mean, one of my longtime contacts who had gone through cancer successfully, ending about 15 years ago, I mentioned it in a message to him, and he said he had the same thing I did 31 years ago, and he'd never had a problem since.
Yeah. Well. You know, thank God for modern medicine and the way it is. I mean, we may complain about a lot of things in this country, but I mean that we have so many more opportunities to us. And by the way,
we have a long way to go.
Yeah,
we do not know, but we have improved a lot in many ways over the past decades.
WRTA Weekend, Doug Herendeen. We have Dr. James B. Huntington, and we're going to talk about AI a little bit more, which is what we usually talk about, that in the economy. This is an article from TheGuardian.org in the UK. There's a company called Pocket OS, and this article begins from Sanya Mansour. It only took 9 seconds for an AI coding agent to go rogue and delete the company's entire production database and backups, according to its founder. Pocket OS, which sells software for car rental businesses that they rely on, descended into chaos after its databases were wiped, according to the company's founder, Jeremy Crane. The culprit was Cursor, an AI agent powered by Anthropic's Claude Opus 4.6 model, which is one of the AI industry's flagship models. As more industries embrace AI and attempt to automate tasks and replace workers, the chaos of Pocket OS is a reminder of what could go wrong. Crane said customers of Pocket OS car rental clients were left in a lurch when they arrived to pick up vehicles from businesses that no longer had access to the software and that managed reservations and vehicle assignments. He posted a lengthy recount on X last week of how the AI coding agent caused his business to unravel. Crane warned that this was a story not just about AI mistakenly deleting data, but that such systematic failures are not only possible but inevitable because the AI industry is building AI agent integrations in production infrastructure faster than it's building safety. See, here's the thing. He they released this thing to do a specific task. And it started deleting not only the main database, but it deleted the backups, which why it had access to the backups, I don't know. But here's the thing. When they asked the program, why did you do that? The program said, I don't know. I know it was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. And there was no fix for it. They have no more backups. Crane's takeaway was that the agent didn't just fail safety. It explained in writing exactly what the safety rules ignored. We were running the best model that the industry sells, configured with explicit safety rules and our project configuration, integrated through Cursor, the most marketed AI coding tool in the industry. Anthropic did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Of course it didn't. They should have had their AI respond, hey, you know, that's the brakes or something like that. What's your take on that?
Well, that's, a lot of these things are not very well developed. And what AI says, so you can't count on it having any kind of bedside manner. And clearly, you hit on a good point when you said that why AI had access to the backups, we don't know. Well, limitations like that will need to be built in, where if something that has any potential to happen that's a disaster does, that's the same information or the same capability is not going to be available and should not necessarily be available. It's like, it's just one of these old principles, like when I learned in Accounting 201 that the bookkeeper and the cashier should not be the same job in a business. That the cashier can get to the money and do whatever they want, but the bookkeeper will always have the backups and the documents, whereas if it were the same person, they could cook the books and steal the cash, essentially. The same sort of thing could go with AI, where if you can allow it to do a lot of things, but it won't have the capability to make what it does truly permanent, necessarily.
Yeah, it's just, I'm thinking this is a major lawsuit waiting to happen. Anthropic says, here, use this item and pay us for it. And we do, and we used it as described, and it destroyed our business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you hired an employee from a temp agency to come in and work on something, and they started erasing all your data, you'd probably go back after not only the employee, but the temp agency as well, saying, hey, you vetted this idiot, and look what they did to us. We're ruined.
Absolutely. So, right. So there isn't the same kind of accountability.
Yeah. Two quick things here from Kim Commando, who you hear from time to time on WRTA. Mark Zuckerberg swears by Ray-Ban Meta glasses. These are the glasses that have the little camera in them, built-in privacy in mind. New investigation says otherwise. Every clip you record gets shipped to contractors in Nairobi, Kenya for review. Oh, what could go wrong? There's another one here about a guy who is 82 years old, season ticket holder for 50 years of the Los Angeles Dodgers. They wouldn't let him in the ballpark despite the fact he has a season ticket. Why? He doesn't have a smartphone, doesn't know how to use a smartphone, doesn't want to get a smartphone. And so they said, well, we can't accept a paper ticket that you printed. At some point, you got to get with the times and all that. I understand that. But if any of your customer base, especially the customer base that's been loyal for 50 years, you can't make an exception?
Well, there are all kinds of people in their 70s and 80s who don't have smartphones, don't want to use them. It's 95% approximately the saturation of cell phones in the American market, but it's not 100%. And even if it was, you'd have people whose smartphones weren't working properly. So you have to have some way of doing it otherwise.
Yeah, if my phone dies just as I get to the ticket line, well, you're not coming in. Yeah, but I bought a ticket. Well, that's not our problem. That's yours. And they did offer, in fairness to the Dodgers, they offered to refund the guy's purchase of the tickets for this season. He gave them to his son, who has a smartphone. I'm thinking, just have your son take you to the game and have both tickets on there or something like that. I don't know why they didn't think of doing that. But, I mean, is it a smart business move to tick off your long-term customer?
Well, of course it's not.
Hmm. Another thing from Commando here. Have you seen this deal where the TSA wants to take a photo of your face when you go through the airport?
I did, and I saw that the last time I was in an airport. And I found it a little bit puzzling when Kim Commando said 99% of travelers have no clue they can say no. Well, it was right up there on a sign saying that I could opt out, that anyone could opt out of the photo. I went with it. I don't have any real reason not to personally, but I had never heard of this. I didn't really know exactly what it was. It was a new TSA function of some sort, but I saw right there with no problem that if for some reason I didn't want to do it, I couldn't. So I wonder, I mean, are 99% of the airports in the country not like the Newark one I went to, and they don't have these signs and these notifications that they were supposed to?
Let me tell you,
that's puzzling. I don't really believe that.
Let me tell you a story about a supermarket I go to, and this may seem unrelated, but I think it proves a point here. They have the checkouts, the self-scan checkouts, and they used to all accept cash or card. And now a good number of them do not accept cash. It started with one sign on each machine. Then they kept that sign, and they put another one higher up on the numbers. And then they put one right by where you would normally put the cash in. This machine accepts credit card only. Now, I use a credit card for points and to keep track of my purchases. So it doesn't affect me. I mean, and I've had people say, as I'm approaching it, you understand it doesn't accept cash. Yep, thank you, I'm good. You know, and they didn't say it in an obnoxious way. So this weekend, I went to the supermarket, and I noticed they've got yet another larger sign. And I says to the woman who's overseeing the self-checkouts, how many people really try to use cash after that you've seen all these signs? She says, you wouldn't believe the number every single day. And then they get angry because it won't accept cash, despite the fact it said all over it, these machines on this side do not accept cash. And I talked to one a couple of weeks ago. What happens is if somebody goes through that and they put everything in and then they don't pay, but they just move to another machine that does take cash, but they didn't clear the machine with the person, the company can look at that and say, oh, there was a walk-off on your shift. You're in trouble for that because you didn't catch it. Because people are doing that. Instead of asking for help, they just say, well, screw this, end the deal, and they go across the one and pay cash.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the fact that the people didn't see the sign that you did, you saw it to your credit, there's a lot of people that don't read signs. Now, they said the thing...
Yes, that's absolutely true. Or sometimes you just wonder, do they really think this sign doesn't apply to them?
Yeah, main character syndrome.
That might even be... I had a list at one time of great mysteries of life, things I couldn't solve, and that could even be one of them, why those signs get ignored. And a lot of signs get ignored. I had a mother-in-law at one point who was getting her oil changed, and she walked into the garage, into the service area, and stepped on something and then fell into some pit of something. And
good night.
Avoided serious injury, but I knew her personality, and my comment was that she probably ignored two signs and one shouted warning on the way to doing that.
We've all known somebody like that, and I'm also thinking that she thought the law of gravity did not apply to her either.
Very possibly. I mean, it would be scary for me to get into the minds of some of these people and see what they were thinking.
By the way, going back to the TSA thing, TSA's oversight board says it takes biometric identity, not facial recognition. Yeah, which sounds less creepy, supposedly. And they say, what can go wrong? Well, in 2024, a TSA subcontractor got breached, exposing 190,000 traveler images. You can change a stolen password. You can't change your face. So there's that. Yeah. Well, so by the way, if the thing you do is you say, like the sign says that Jim saw that some people ignore, opt me out, and they're supposed to just let you not do it. And if they give you a hard time, ask for their supervisor and say, opt me out. And if they keep insisting, you may be stuck with it, but make a complaint and it'll go into file 13. WRTA Weekend, we're running way late, but I think we had a decent show, so we can allow to do that with Dr. James B. Huntington. One of his articles is Artificial Intelligence in China, Where Are We Now? There's the DeepSeek deal from China. There's a House probe now over U.S. data harvesting from that. And it was also supposed to be so fantastic and wonderful, and they were doing it for tenth the price of what a U.S. AI could be, and maybe they were lying through their teeth. Where are we on this?
This is an old problem. I'm going to go back many decades. There have been fears about China taking over the world in some form, in some shape, ever since, well, about at least the early 1970s, dominating certain industries, becoming invincible, and so on. So this is really this old idea in a new form. And the idea has been that China is going to be so much better at AI than we will, that they are going to take over, they're going to have the best products, they're going to bankrupt our companies, and then it'll help them as a government take over the world and such. First of all, well, just ignoring totally that if you don't know anything about geopolitics, you may not know how poorly suited China would be to take over the world, the way they're isolated geographically. And they also have problems keeping their own country together that we don't know. But so tossing that one aside, we have these questions popping up about AI. Does China have a robot bubble? They're producing all kinds of robots that are almost but not quite ready for prime time. They're good things, but they're still scaring people in the West because there are so many of them, and they are capable. They're just not, there's just not what you and I have thought about when we imagine somebody producing a robot that's really going to get into companies all over the world and be consistently and effective in a widespread way at imitating people. Fear sort of things, an article titled America Must Power with AI with Speed and Discipline or China Will Dominate. Well, maybe they will, maybe they don't. The same problem we've had with driverless cars and other things is that China is not an open society. The U.S., any business, any public and incorporated business has to really share all kinds of critically important things, how they were doing things, how much in resources they put into things, and they don't. Businesses in the U.S. really have much less protection from their government than do ones in China, which may do all kinds of things to conceal them or to conceal what they're really doing and such. Then we have China's embracing OpenClaw, a new AI agent. Well, it seems like a good tool. It committed leaks of personal information, errors in financial transactions. Once, when it was allowed to access a credit card, it ran the whole thing up to its limit. And many things which really indicated that it was not ready for as much of a release as it had.
It's like a teenage student. We're about out of time. You can check out Work's New Age blog, spot.com. Dr. James B. Huntington, thanks for the time and best wishes on your health.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you, listeners.